You don't have to have bruises to be abused. If you don't know what's in your bank account, if you're given an allowance, if you are afraid to ask about money, this episode is for you. Financial expert and author Emily Guy Burkin joins Women Winning Divorce to expose how financial abuse hides in plain sight and how you can protect yourself before and during divorce.
Welcome to Women Winning Divorce, the podcast helping successful women navigate divorce with dignity so you can protect yourself, your children, and your assets. I'm Heather Quick, founding attorney at Florida Women's Law Group, where women win at life.
This week, I sat down with Plutus Award-winning personal finance writer and author Emily Guy Burkin to talk about financial abuse, how it shows up, why women often miss it, and what protection looks like before and during divorce. This conversation is about awareness, strategy, and financial empowerment. Welcome to this week's episode of Women Winning Divorce. I'm Heather Quick, owner and attorney at Florida Women's Law Group. Today, Emily Guy Burkin, a Plutus Award-winning personal finance writer, joins us. Emily is the author of The 5 Years Before You Retire and co-author of Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management, as well as 3 other books on personal finance. She specializes in behavioral finance and helping individuals understand the psychology behind money decisions, especially during major life transitions like divorce. Today, Emily and I will be discussing what financial abuse actually looks like and why it's often missed, the subtle ways financial control shows up in a marriage, why smart, capable women don't always recognize it. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. This is going to be a great conversation. I can't wait to get into it. So for our listeners, though, Emily, would you share a little bit about yourself and how you began focusing on personal finance and behavioral money decisions?
Yeah, I like to tell people that I tripped and fell backwards into writing about money because I'm an English teacher by training. I never intended to be a financial writer. I taught high school English for 4 years. And then my husband and I moved after my 4th year of teaching when I was pregnant with my eldest child. And because we are really good at timing, my child was due at the beginning of the next school year. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to find a teaching job because I would have had to immediately go on maternity leave. So the plan was for me to take 1 year off to stay home with the baby. And I thought I would try to find some freelance writing gigs for that first year. One of the first jobs that I landed was for a financial website. My dad was a financial planner, and I've always been a bit of a money nerd. And so I was like, oh, I could do this with the kind of like unearned confidence that
right,
one has.
Right, of course.
And it turned out to like fit like a glove between a apparently, I was the only kid between my sister, my cousin, and me when my dad would talk about money at home at the dinner table. I was the one who was paying attention.
Love it. Love it.
And there were, you know, various things where, like, I really was, like, interested in money all my life, even though I thought of myself as a poet or a very literary woman. The fact that I had spent 4 years teaching and I thought of myself as a writer, I brought that kind of sensibility to writing about money, which many of my financial colleagues were struggling with. So like they were like very dry, whereas I brought a kind of more writerly sensibility to talking about money. So it took off. And what I like to tell people is, you know, I was going to stay home with the baby for 1 year. The baby is now 15. So it was kind of accidental that I ended up doing this. And then it ended up kind of merging two of my biggest interests, because I've always been very interested in why I make the decisions I do and how people end up making decisions that end up hurting each other for reasons that seem like they're really trying to do things that for the right reason. So I ended up, I've always been interested in like sociology and kind of fell into behavioral finance and behavioral economics, which is kind of an offshoot of sociology. And that I found much more interesting than traditional economics, which assumes that we're all rational actors. And if you have ever had a bad day or like lost a job and gone shopping to make yourself feel better, or anything like that, you know that we are not rational actors.
So true.
Yeah. And so, especially since I have been a bit of a money nerd, there have been times where I have made a spending decision and like, you know, the next day gone, why did I do that?
Right. Yeah.
This has been something that I've found really fascinating and really have explored with my writing career. And have wanted to use to try to help people, because so often people beat themselves up for the kind of financial decisions that are irrational and that you then later on go like, oh my goodness, I'm bad with money. No, it's not that you're bad with money. It's that we're human and we make human decisions, and money happens to be a resource that works in very black and white ways when we have very gray decision-making capabilities. And so because of that, we end up hurting ourselves. We end up making disordered decisions that don't fit with our goals. And it really has a outsized influence on how we feel about ourselves. And so I feel like by focusing on behavioral economics and talking about how we can change the way we look at money, we can improve the way we feel about ourselves and feel about our money, and also help us make better decisions. I don't want to say better. Help us make decisions that better fit our goals.
Okay. I like that. All right. Well, that's a fascinating story and not what I would have expected. So it's super cool. Right? Because like you always want to know, how do you get to where you are? And usually it's a really interesting story in a roundabout kind of way ends up getting you into the place where really you were meant to be. And you can, you know, offer so much to everyone. So let's start with clarity. What is financial abuse?
So financial abuse is when someone with more financial power keeps another person from accessing financial power. And what's interesting is you think more financial power, more money. It doesn't necessarily mean that, because oftentimes in heterosexual marriages, the man has more financial power even if the woman out-earns him.
Interesting.
And that is because of the way our society is made up. So one of the statistics that infuriates me is that when women out-earn men in marriages, she still does more housework.
Yeah.
And so that is a form of financial abuse.
Ooh, okay.
Because that is abusing her free time. So that is, time and money are very intimately connected. It is the more classic type of financial abuse has to do with keeping the person with less power from accessing finance. And then you'll see that, for example, where, you know, the classic version of it is you'll see a young wife with an older husband who he won't allow her to work, keep her home with multiple children at home, and like give her like, you only have so much money to spend on groceries, diapers, and all of that.
Right.
And then there's nothing left over for her to have, you know, be able to go get coffee with a friend or be able to do anything for herself. That is the very classic version of financial abuse.
Okay. Right.
But there is financial abuse at every level of income and every stage for, and including for very high powered and high income earning women with men who earn less than them. They can be financially abused as well.
Wow. Now, you've written extensively about how emotions and psychology influence money choices. So how does that dynamic show up in marriages where the financial abuse is present?
So what I have seen a lot of, and I know some of this is anecdotal because it's something that I've seen over and over again, is so many women were raised with this idea of I want to be an equal partner. And there is kind of exploited by the men in their lives by saying, yes, we are going to be an equal partner. So we're going to split the bills down the middle. And the thing about money is you can cut those down the middle because it's math.
Right,
it's very easy
right.
to math that math.
Yes.
And so if he is earning more money and you're saying, okay, we're splitting the bills down the middle and she happens to be earning less, or if, for instance, she put him through school.
Okay.
And then he's earning more, something like that. It feels fair, but he has a whole heck of a lot more walking around money or fun money or money to put into his retirement accounts than she does. But it feels fair, and it is part of her money script, her feeling of like, I'm being a good feminist. I'm being like a strong woman. I don't need no man because she is doing exactly half because the math is mathing.
Okay.
Rather than it being like we're doing a percentage based on what we each earn.
Because that would be fair.
That would be fair.
That would be more equitable. Maybe not equal, but definitely more equitable.
Yes. And what's tough is that time is also something you can math that way. Because 24 hours is 24 hours. But we don't do that when it comes to things like the household labor. We don't do that when it comes to like, you know what, I'm doing dishes, laundry, cleaning up the, like cleaning the bathroom, all of that, which is, you know, all of these are daily chores, and you cut the grass and change the oil, which is a weekly and yearly chores.
Yeah.
So like, can we do the math of that? That's not equal. There's no similar sort of like split down the middle math in that.
Right.
And if in an inequitable marriage, the wife brings that up, there's the, I earn more money than you. Don't I earn some time to relax on the weekends? And women are so often socialized to believe that they can't ask for what they want. And then we've also been like, it's this kind of blowback against, you know, we've been taught like we shouldn't ask for more, and we want to be strong, independent, equal. And it's kind of been weaponized in a way.
And, you know, it is like when you said that, right? Like the in this example, it's like, well, I need a break. And yet I think men traditionally, right, and stereotypically or whatever, they're going to tell you that, like, I got to have a break. You know, I just got home. I had a busy day. I need an hour to myself, right? But women don't do that automatically in my experience and experience with other women. If we practice and we can recognize when we need a little space, but generally, no. Right? Mm-hmm. We don't get an hour when we get home from work just to go sit in the den and watch the news or whatever. No, we've got to jump right in. And that's just very, I think that's so like what, culturally, socially, just sort of the way we've all been conditioned.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's, we are working our way away from that
very slowly.
And, you know, some of it, if you look at like advertisements from like the 40s and 50s, like, you know, they have advertisements of like the family showing up with like slippers and a whiskey for dad, you know, like welcome daddy home from the hard day at work. And so like we're, what, 70, 80 years away from that. And like that was the expectation for our grandparents.
Right.
So, and we're trying to teach our sons that that's not what happens, but they're still getting the, like, we're saying that to our sons, but they're still seeing the dynamic. And there is still, because of the way money works in our society, because it is something that you can add and subtract, it's math, because of the way it works.
Right.
And something that I like to say consistently, money doesn't actually exist. So it is a shared delusion. We have all collectively decided that we believe in this fictional thing.
Right.
You know, it doesn't exist in nature. You can't eat it. You can't build shelter out of it. I mean, you could technically make clothes out of it, but it wouldn't be very warm. If we all decided tomorrow that we don't use money anymore, it wouldn't matter. If you decided, you know what, I'm going to go be like a mountain person and live off the grid, you wouldn't need money. You could technically do that. Mm-hmm. You'd need shelter. You'd need food. You'd need water, but you wouldn't need money.
Right.
So because it doesn't exist, because it is a shared delusion, we can put on money, or we do put on money, whatever our emotional views of it, our neuroses, our psychological viewpoint of it, like whatever's in our brains is what we put on money.
Mm.
And so that is why money is the number one cause of friction between married couples, and why that first knockdown, drag out fight that married couples have is pretty much always over money. I mean, not necessarily like, you know, the sex, religion, children, those are also the big ones. But it's because you will make a money decision and your spouse will go, what are you doing? Because it doesn't make any sense to them, where you're going like, how does this not make sense to you? Because this is just how it is. And they're going, no, it's not. That's not how it is. Because you're talking about two different things with the same name, because it's a delusion we share. And it's a delusion we share that seems like it exists because you can add it and subtract it and it follows the rules of math.
Right.
And yeah. And it confers power.
Yes.
Because we give it power.
Give it power.
Collectively as society.
Now, many women don't label their experience as abuse. So if you will dig into what are some of the subtle red flags that financial control is happening.
So if you are feeling hesitant to ask or bring up something about money, so whether big or small, that hesitance is often a red flag, an indicator that there's something hinky about money.
Okay. Okay.
There should be openness. Now, money is often a cause of friction between married couples, but in a non-abusive relationship, you should be able to say like, hey, I really want to be able to, you know, whatever it is, I really want to be able to free up this much money to get a manicure once a month because I just feel so much more put together. And I know that that is like a quote unquote frivolous expense, but it feels really good to me. And like, I'm sure we can find a way to make it work. So can we, and like, if the idea of that just set your teeth on edge, that's a red flag.
Okay. Okay.
So that's one. Another is if you're hesitant to talk to your friends about a fight that you had with your spouse about money.
Okay.
And this depends a little bit on how open you are. Some people just don't talk about money, and I get that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're generally pretty open with your friends about when you talk about your spouse, if you're feeling like, I feel really ashamed of this conversation. I feel really ashamed of how this went down. And I just don't, I don't want to talk about this. I don't want anyone to know that this is what's going on. That's a red flag.
Okay. Okay.
If you don't know where you would get money to do something for yourself, that's a red flag. In every marriage, each partner should have some money that is their own. And I'm not talking about like, you know, a separate bank account that they don't know about or anything like that. But each
knowing that they have money, that this is my money to do what I want with.
Yes, exactly. And if you don't, if there is no money, like, you know, other than like a tenner that you've, like that you find in a coat somewhere.
That's right, that you found in your coat, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Or like the coins in the couch cushions. That is a red flag. And if every conversation about money devolves into a fight, there is never a conversation about money that doesn't cause friction, that's a red flag.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, why do so many intelligent, high-achieving women often miss these warning signs?
I think there's a couple of things going on. I think one is with high achieving women, especially if they're making good money, there is this kind of assumption that I'm doing okay, so it's okay. You know, if he's anxious about money, if he's a little strange about money, he's got his and I've got mine. So we're okay.
Right, right, right.
And so there's this sense of like, I've got this insulation because I make good money. So I think there's a little bit of that going on. And I have seen that happen where the wife might be like earning more than the husband. And so she might see some things that are kind of red flags, but she's like, I make more. It's going to be okay. And then illness or children or life makes things change. And so she's no longer the higher earning spouse.
Right, right.
And then it's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so that insulation, the financial insulation, is no longer there. So I think that is part of it. I'm reminded of, you know, the Marilyn Monroe song, Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like there is that kind of maternal wisdom that was passed down that, like, you know, if you have money of your own, you can kind of handle anything.
Right, right.
But you can't always count on the money of your own.
Mm-hmm.
And you might think like, these are red flags, but they're little red flags.
Right, right. Yeah.
So I think that's part of it. And I think those are one of the things that that we see happen. Then the other thing that I think happens is it is so normalized. Like, okay, our society has given us so many examples and has taught us that, like, you know, men, they just do this. They just get like that. It's just how men are, those silly billies. Mm-hmm. And so we're encouraged to just accept these red flags and this bad behavior because everywhere we look, we see examples of like, he's a good guy. He just gets a little like this about that. He just gets a little like this. He's otherwise such a great guy. And so, you know, everywhere from like pop culture to, you know, examples of, you know, celebrities to everything, we see messages telling us to overlook red flags because, like, deep down, he's a good guy.
Right, right, right. And, you know, wanting to keep the peace or harmony. And I think, like, with what you're saying, society's saying, oh, but he's a good guy. And then you have this self-talk, like, oh, it's okay, right? This outweighs this, right? The good outweighs the bad. And we minimize it, I think, a lot.
Well,
right?
And we also are taught to second-guess ourselves. So, like, something will happen, we're like, was that really what I thought it was? No, it couldn't have been what I thought it was.
No, it's not that bad. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We talk ourselves out of it instead of really, you know, listening to our gut and our instincts on it. Now, okay, divorce often reveals financial realities. How does financial abuse escalate or become more visible when divorce is on the table?
So my parents divorced when I was 3 years old. This is one of those things, like, I kind of can't believe my mom told me this, but she used to say, you don't really know a man until you divorce him. Which I'm like, I don't want to know this about my dad, mom.
I know, really. I know. So, but it was all out of love, right? They're trying to help us. Like,
yeah.
But I'm going to teach you. You're going to learn from this.
Yeah. But some of the things that you'll see is the things that were on the down low during the marriage become overt during the divorce. So things like gifts will be like, you have to pay me back for that, or I want that back. Things like, for instance, if she paid for him to go to school, there will be a denial of that. So it will very much become what's mine is mine and what's yours is mine on his part. And so he will begin to say the quiet part out loud, in that, like, everything is transactional at that point. So there are a lot of people who equate money with love. And I think divorce often brings that out of people. And so if the financial abuser, and I think financial abusers are often people who equate money with love, if the financial abuser is one of those people, they will want to squeeze every single dollar out of the divorce as possible because they're clawing back their love. And that might also mean drawing out the divorce as long as possible to force their ex-wife to spend more money on the lawyer. Even if it means they also have to spend more money on the lawyer, because that is another way to show how they feel.
Right. Absolutely. Now, what are the biggest financial mistakes women make when leaving a financially controlling spouse?
So one is not shutting, like getting their money out of joint accounts ahead of time. So if you're a financially controlling spouse, you need to be very vigilant as you're planning to leave. In the same way, any abusive spouse, the most dangerous time is when you're leaving. It is good to, under like cover of secrecy, move money out of joint accounts when you can.
Right, right.
Serving the divorce papers, or else you will lose that money and never see it again. So that's one.
That is, and often women don't believe me. They don't listen to us.
Yes.
That happens too often. We're like, you know, you can, I'm not asking you to spend it. I'm just asking you to move it so that you have control. And they, oh, he won't do that. That won't happen. Mm-hmm. They don't believe it.
And I have a very different view of money than most people do. I can just, the way that my brain works, I have ADHD, and the way that my brain works, I can let money go. So most people are not like me. For me, freedom would be worth more than money. So if I needed to get out of someplace, I would be willing to let the money go.
Yes.
Most people, and that's also because I have complete and utter faith in my ability to make more.
I think that's also, you have the freedom to know you can earn it as well. You're not afraid of how would it come back? How would I survive?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I don't expect or want other people to feel the need to emulate me. And so that's why I say, if you don't have that same kind of conviction, move the money.
Move the money, right.
Move the money, because fighting someone for money is the most emotionally and mentally draining thing you've ever had to do. When my father passed away, my inheritance was stolen by my stepmother. Yeah. And that's another type of financial abuse.
Right.
My sister and I ended up suing her for it. I would have let it go, but it was important to my sister to fight for it. My sister's one of the most important people in my life. So I was like, I have your back.
Right.
It was awful. Mm-hmm. So it is really, really important to protect yourself from having to go through something like that.
Absolutely.
The other thing is, listen to whatever it is your lawyer recommends. And even if it sounds outlandish or unreasonable, like what you're saying, like the women you advise say, oh, he'd never do that. They're speaking from experience. And that is going to protect you. Even if it turns out to not be necessary, it's better to have it and not need it.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Now, how can women, this is a big one, avoid intimidation or pressure to settle unfairly?
So that's a tough one, because when you're getting that kind of intimidation and pressure, it's
right.
What I find really helpful is like kind of doing a visualization. So like imagine being on the other side. Imagine like 2 years, 3 years, however far in the future, who you are when you have one, and you have everything that you deserve, and how proud you are of yourself, how well set up your children are if you've got children, and how satisfying it is to know that you did not bow to pressure and to know that you made it through the intimidation.
Mm-hmm.
And when you are facing that pressure and that intimidation, be that person, be that woman on the other side of it, because then you'll know you've already done it.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds kind of woo-woo, but sometimes you need to channel a different version of yourself.
Yeah, right.
It's not always possible. As I said, like, if I need freedom, I'm willing to give up money.
Right.
So, feeling pressure to settle, I can feel myself going like, oh my God, I just want to be done.
Right. You know yourself. I know
myself.
Yes.
If it's something where like, you know, I'm thinking about, hey, my boys need this money so they can go to college.
Right. Yeah.
My 50-year-old self, my 60-year-old self is so proud of me for not doing this, for not settling.
Right.
And I want to be the woman she's proud of. That is so much more motivating to me than like, all right, I'm going to fight this.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, that makes sense. And that, I think it's smart. It may sound woo-woo, but sometimes we need to like step out of what's right in front of us and mm-hmm. give some grace, but also think beyond today, think mm-hmm. beyond the pressure and what feels uncomfortable right now, because mm-hmm. a lot of things feel uncomfortable, but it'll pass. Mm-hmm. You just have to sometimes maybe focus on something else, you know, mm-hmm. like you said, mm-hmm. your future self, which I love that for sure. I'm going to copy it. I'm going to use that statement, but, let's talk about, for a woman listening today who is starting to recognize these patterns, what is the first empowering step she can take today?
So the first step to take today is tell yourself, remind yourself, I deserve more. And that's something like if you have to like write it on a post-it note and put it on the mirror, put it in a notes app on your phone and tell yourself that every day. Mm-hmm. And what that will do is when you are saying, you know what, I'm going to go on a spa weekend with my best girlfriend, and your husband says, we don't have the money for that. You can say, I deserve more. And yes, we do. Mm-hmm. Like it will already be in your head. You are not going to be like going to be willing to capitulate to whatever it is he's saying mm-hmm. that is untrue, that is based in whatever his money psychology is, whatever the financial abuse is. So starting with, I deserve more. And then when are these moments of him trying to start with the abusive language, start with these abusive moments, there will be friction. And that's something that is maybe why you have accepted less for so long.
Right.
But reminding yourself daily, I deserve more, or even record yourself saying it and have it be an alarm that goes off regularly on your phone, that will help you, you know, stiffen your spine and refuse to accept less when he tries to keep you from taking what you deserve. And then it might surprise you. This might be something where you may have like folded yourself into smaller shape to fit into a box. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you push back, he might be like, okay, you might find that he has been doing some stuff to make himself comfortable, but he was willing to accept discomfort that you didn't realize.
Yeah.
You don't know.
You don't.
Things might be better than you assume.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know until you insist on what you deserve.
Mm-hmm. I think that's great. Now, Emily, before we go, our show is called Women Winning Divorce, and I would like to know, what does winning at life mean to you?
So winning at life to me means embracing every day, mm-hmm. Just feeling as if each day is a new opportunity to enjoy myself, to love out loud all the people in my life, to do work that I enjoy and feel like the world needs, and to do the things that I want to do in the world.
Nice, nice. I love it. That's great. Now, lastly, where can our listeners find you and your books for more information and resources?
Yes, I am at emilyguyburkin.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn under my name, Emily Guy Burkin. And I'm on Threads at Emily Guy Burkin. Sure.
Well, we've reached the end of our show today. And thank you so much, Emily, for shedding light on such an important and really often misunderstood issue. Financial abuse hides in plain sight, and awareness is the first step towards reclaiming control, confidence, and long-term financial security. Thank you.
Listeners, if you or someone you know in the Northeast Florida area is going through or even thinking about divorce, you're not alone. Taking that first step can feel overwhelming, but it doesn't have to be. Our newsletter is filled with actionable advice tailored to guide you through this process. By signing up, you'll gain the tools to face the unknown with courage and see if we're the right fit to support you during this life-changing time. Don't wait. Click the link in the show notes, fill out the form, and take the first step toward building a brighter future today.